This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
We had an election night in Texas. We'll talk about that, why it matters for everybody. Alex Sawyer joins us. Jerry Dunleavy with a wild story. What a night tonight on I'm Right. All right. I'm so excited to talk about this, although we have to start out on a very somber note. Last night, I know there were other elections going on around the country, North Carolina, places like that, but in Texas, there's very important things happening for everybody, not just for the state of Texas, you see, because Texas had primary elections yesterday for a governor, for senator, for all kinds of important primary elections happen. And of course, as you can imagine, every single person who has my cell phone number was texting me last night about the results and what do you think. So I told all of them, just watch I'm Right tomorrow. I'll tell you. I'll lay it all out. I can't respond to everything right now. I'll lay it all out for you. So here it is. Here's the somber part of it. You see, Jasmine Crockett, she was running in the Democrat primary, trying to get the nomination against some James Tallarico guy, which we'll get to that. Jasmine Crockett is a total disaster of a candidate. A complete disaster in every way. Nobody likes the angry black woman. It's just one of the least likable demographics in the United States of America. Loud, ignorant, angry black woman just doesn't land well anywhere outside of heavily black districts. It's just not something that can win because everyone finds it unappealing. Nobody wants to be around that person. But I love that Jasmine Crockett has been part of the Democrat Party because she weighs the entire party down. And I know you're not going to vote for a Democrat. I'm not going to vote for a Democrat. But normies, you know how they are. They'll vote for a Democrat, and then they'll vote for a Republican, and then they'll vote for a Democrat. These people don't know anything. And so sometimes all they need is a reason to not vote for a party. Jasmine Crockett, oftentimes with the stupid, loud, ignorant things she says, gave normies a reason to vote against Democrats. And there's something else I have so adored about Jasmine Crockett. I call her a chaos agent. I bet you know people. I bet you've had people. Maybe you have one right now. People in your life who are chaos agents. Maybe you're related to them. Maybe you work with them. And when I say chaos agent, this is what I mean. Every time you pick up the phone and it's them, there's some horrible drama, disaster happening. Every time they go to a new job, a new school, immediately they just start blowing everything up. Everything's a disaster. They bring chaos with them everywhere they go. And that, of course, is Jasmine Crockett. And I think we on the right have benefited greatly that Democrats have been saddled with this chaos agent. Here she was after she lost.
We encourage each and every one of you to remain resilient. We cannot allow this type of behavior to be rewarded, because so long as they know that they can win, even if it means cheating, then they will continue to do it.
Yes, that's why she's great. But she lost. And now her political career is over. She got redistricted out. She's gone. It's over. But before we move on to James Tallarico, I do think, out of respect for Jasmine Crockett's illustrious political career, we should honor her by playing once again how she was introduced when she announced she was running for Senate. Here it was.
Let's get into it.
Okay. She ain't never scared and she ain't never been. Who is willing to go toe-to-toe against the president? I can't wrap my head around someone who votes Republican. She advocate for feeding kids. They protect folks touching them. Trump invading his own country with our army. What a joke. We remember Pearl Harbor by illegally bombing boats. What y'all thought we wasn't gonna do nothing, buddy? Think again. They only trying to scare out of running because they think she'll win. Listen, thought I told y'all we ain't never scared. Now look who name on the docket. Got two words for every racist bigot. Jasmine Crockett.
Y'all hear the words.
you. So which side you wanna choose? Me, I hope my money goes to side that isn't trying to say affordability's a hoax. She stand on business, Austin.
Oh, I can't believe we cut that off. I was jamming. Anyway, I swear that's real, by the way. That's not like a Saturday Night Live skit. That was real. And shockingly, she didn't win the primary. Now, I do have bad news for Democrats. Maybe they think they avoided that big missile. But James Tallarico, he's doing this thing. He's been doing the podcast circuit where he's out there and he's trying to make communism sound reasonable. I'm the reasonable communist. See, Texans, I'm as Texan as you. But you see, the problem is James Tallarico has been a politician. He's in the Texas legislature. He's been a politician around here for a long time. And he's been a far-left communist for a long time. And because of that, he's been on video for a long time saying things that Texans are about to watch him say on television commercials.
Trans children are God's children, made in God's own image. There's nothing wrong with them. Nothing at all. They are perfect. They are beautiful. And they are sacred.
Before we go further, I want to acknowledge that our trans community needs abortion care too. Defending trans Texans is something we have to do.
God is non-binary.
Our southern border should be like our front porch. There should be a giant welcome mat out front and a lock on the door.
Good luck, Democrats. But that, of course, brings us to our party. Because the Republican is going to win. It's going to be John Cornyn or Ken Paxton. The election was close enough last night that now there's going to be a runoff election. John Cornyn is the swampiest of swamp rats. If you've ever spent a minute complaining about rhinos or the swamp, John Cornyn is the face of all that. He has betrayed us time and time and time again in the GOP Senate. And we have now in front of us an opportunity not just to remove John Cornyn, to send a message to the other swamp rats who screw us over all the time. We can make them afraid if we can burn down John Cornyn in the primary. And John Cornyn knows full well who his enemies are.
I know Republicans, voters, and as I said earlier, really it's a question of who bothers to show up. If only the most radical people show up in the primary, then I think that's going to be a challenge.
How do you think John Cornyn, he said that on CBS, radical people. Let me ask you something. How do you think John Cornyn talks about you when the cameras are off and he's in there in Washington, D.C., with his Democrat senators? How do you think he talks about you? You gun lovers. People who want the deportation of every single illegal in this country. People who love the Second Amendment. That's what John Cornyn says on camera. What he says when the camera is off and nobody's recording about you, oh my gosh, he holds you in such disdain. And now, we, in a red state, have an opportunity to send a message, not just to John Cornyn. He's gone, hopefully. Not just to John Cornyn. We have an opportunity to send a message to the other dorks in the GOP Senate who hate you and hate me and badmouth us all the time. And for too long, red state GOP voters have been lazy and stupid. Too lazy to get off the couch and vote against the establishment. Too stupid to realize these people screw us over all the time, so they go vote for the guy. Well, I voted for Cornyn 10 times. We've had to suffer from the stupidity and laziness of the GOP red state primary voter for a long time, and it looks like the GOP red state primary voter is starting to awaken from his slumber. It looks like maybe we have an opportunity to do the right thing here and get rid of that dirt ball. We have a long way to go. We have a lot of them to get rid of, but this is an opportunity. I mean, these people are all over red states. How is this guy the governor of Oklahoma?
But I will also say, you know, even my Democrat governor colleagues, they're not trying to get illegals here to turn them into voters. I don't believe that's what Democrat, you know, politicians are trying to do. And just like Republicans get a bad rap that people think that Republicans don't like immigrants, that's not true. There's some common ground that if we can sit down together, we can figure this out.
That is so pathetic and embarrassing. That guy's not the governor of Maine. He's the governor of blood red Oklahoma, because GOP red state primary voters are dumb and lazy. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Chip Roy, running for Texas Attorney General. That race is going to a runoff. We'll talk to Chip tonight. Before we talk to Chip, let me talk to you. Speaking of dumb, you don't have to pay AT&T, Verizon, or T-Mobile. You're paying them too much. It's dumb. You don't want to pay that much. Average family, when they switch to Pure Talk, saves $1,000 a year. I got an email from a lady who was paying $200 a month for two lines with, I think it was AT&T. She switched to Pure Talk. She pays $67 now a month. And this is the company that shares your values, patriotism, the company run by a Vietnam veteran, the company that hires Americans who speak English. There's no reason not to switch. You save money. You support a company who supports you. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV and make the switch today. We'll be back.
Will you rule out the deployment of ICE or CBP to polling places this November?
There are no plans to have ICE officers at our polling locations. And
I'm glad to hear that, but would you rule it out? Would you say it will not happen?
Do you plan on illegal aliens voting in our elections, Senator?
I do not.
It's a very valid point. Why do Democrats keep bringing this up? Joining me now, Congressman Chip Roy, candidate for Attorney General in the great state of Texas. We'll get to that in a few. Chip, it's very clear that Democrats plan on illegals voting in elections, and if they don't plan on that, they sure act like they're planning on that.
Yeah, Jesse, you know, we had Secretary Noem in front of the Judiciary Committee this morning. We had a great exchange, and look, she had a number of families of victims who had lost their lives under the regime of the Biden-Mayorkas administration. And, you know, I asked the question of her on their behalf about whether she believed that their family members would still be alive today if Donald Trump had been president instead of Biden. And she said yes. And Democrats don't seem to care. In fact, one of the family members, a mom, came up to me while we were taking a break and said it's like a gut punch listening to Democrats covering for the bad guys, attacking ICE, attacking the good guys. And so, like, this is more of the same thing over and over again. The president's doing his job. But I also raised the question of why Congress hasn't done what it needs to do to codify the great policies that President Trump's putting forward: fixing asylum, fixing parole, fixing catch and release, fixing the very things that Biden and Mayorkas exploited that obviously led to Mayorkas' impeachment. So, look, it's situation normal in the Democrats. I just want Republicans to step up while we have this majority and deliver good wins for the American people. And if we do that, we'll actually retain the majority. If we play prevent defense, we'll lose.
Where are we at on the SAVE Act? Just at this point in time, I'll be honest, Chip, I've given up hope. I have a new press conference every day from some useless senator telling me why he can't get the thing done. Where are we at on it?
Well, obviously, look, I'm the proud author of the SAVE Act. We added voter ID to it to make the Save America Act. We passed it out of the House. We took every step. We put it in a Senate bill to get rid of half of the procedural hurdles in the Senate. So we've done literally everything we can do. It's now in the hands of the majority leader and 51 Republican senators. Now, you have 50 senators who say they support the bill, but you have a handful that say they refuse to do the tough work of debating the bill on the floor of the Senate. You know why? Because they're afraid of amendments. I mean, Jesse, we get amendments all the time in the House. I sit on the Rules Committee. I vote down tons of amendments, including amendments I support, out of discipline to move a better product across the floor. Leader Thune just needs to carry out discipline. To answer your question, what I predict will happen is that Leader Thune will put it on the Senate floor. He'll probably manage amendments on it for a couple of weeks, which means that's not a talking filibuster. It's just normal debate. They'll offer some amendments. They'll debate it out for a couple of weeks. And unless there's some tsunami of change, which I don't see happening among Democrats, they'll then have a cloture vote. It will fail, and then the bill will be done. And then we'll have to go back to the well in the House and try it again and send it back over. But we're trying to put pressure on Thune to force the hand of Senate Republicans to stand up and actually do the hard work of doing a talking filibuster, which, by the way, works the same way as we do every year on the budget. They're just afraid to do it because they actually don't like the policy, in my view, some of them.
What's the PAUSE Act?
Well, I introduced the PAUSE Act in November to literally pause all immigration. Because if you go back to the 1920s, you know, our country had a pretty high percentage of foreign-born population. Well, today, we have 51.5 million foreign-born. That's about 16% of the population. That's higher than at any point in our history, including the 1920s. And back then, we actually froze immigration for about 40 years. I think we need to do that now. I think we need to freeze immigration. Now, the president has done a good job of pausing or freezing immigration from select countries, some of our more dangerous countries, heavily Muslim countries, where you've got a lot of radicals and extremists who might come to our country. But we haven't gone far enough. We're still having H-1Bs. We're still having a bunch of people coming in from all these countries around the world. So I think we legislatively should pause immigration, at least until we've fixed a host of issues, until we resolve birthright citizenship. It's going through the courts right now. Till we resolve policies like catch and release and asylum and parole. Until we resolve policies like H-1Bs and various visas that have been exploited. Until we resolve policies like overstaying visas. Now, why is that important? This Senegali, who was in Austin, Texas, and shot up a bunch of people that, you know, are in my community, including University of Texas students, this cat came to our country in 2000, overstayed a visa for years, got legal permanent residency status under Bush, and he got it by virtue of his marriage, whatever that was. 6 years later, he gets a citizenship under Obama. Then he tries to get LPR status for two other women. I don't know whether they're additional wives or whether they're divorcing wives. And then in 2022, he gets arrested for hit and run. This is the example of why our system is broken. We've got to pause immigration, clean up the mess, send people home who don't believe in our country. This guy was a radical wearing a sweatshirt saying property of Allah with a Rand t-shirt under it. And he goes and shoots up Americans, including a kid from Texas Tech and a kid from the University of Texas, a young woman who was shot three times in her gut. And she's still recovering, having reconstructive surgery. This is ridiculous, and we need to fix it.
Chip, what's the status on your race for Attorney General?
Well, last night, obviously, we had our primary vote, and look, I'm proud to make the runoff. Two of us ended up in the 30s. Two others dropped out. They were in the teens, and so now we'll have a runoff between myself and Mays Middleton, and we feel good about it. It's going to be May 26th. We believe we've got the name ID, the background, the conservative bona fides, but here's the biggest difference, Jesse. Mays Middleton, with all due respect, who ran a whole host of negative ads, I'm sure you saw them in Houston, making all sorts of wild-eyed claims that are completely false. Mays has literally never practiced law in a courtroom. He's never been in a courtroom. He's never appeared before a judge. He's never prosecuted a bad guy. He's never run the attorney general's office. I have his first assistant. And frankly, he still doesn't even really have a strong conservative track record like I do, serving 8 years in Congress, taking areas in Washington. You know where I stand. You know my background. I've got a history of doing the tough work of being a federal prosecutor and putting bad guys in jail, running the AG's office, knowing how to strategize and litigate, appellate briefs, and all of the hard work there. So I believe we're going to be in really good position. We got to go raise the money because Mays spent $18 million, we think. We got to see the final number. $18 million. I mean, Jesse, I raised about four, took in two out of my federal. I spent more than any other candidate in history. Mays wrote a check as a trust fund kid that he inherited from his granddad and then dropped that on my head over the last several weeks. We'll be fine by May 26th when we go straight to the voters, but I got to go raise the money and get it done.
Pulling for you, Chip. Thank you, my brother. Come back soon. All right. Jerry Dunleavy has an amazing story. Have you noticed all these anti-Iran war protests popped up like as soon as the first bomb was dropping? You're going to want to hear from Jerry on where that money came from. You're also going to want to hear that you can get a great night's sleep every night if you want. You know that? You can get great natural sleep every single night. Imagine just one night, 8 straight hours of sleep. Now imagine you start stringing those together. Imagine a week of that, 2 weeks, what kind of a person you are. And you don't need pills. You don't need to go get a prescription. Have a cup of hot chocolate. Dream powder from Beam is hot chocolate. I have the chocolate cinnamon. It's delicious. But it has natural things in it that put me to sleep. And I just sleep so good. And then when I wake up, I don't have that heavy, groggy feeling. I just feel ready to rock and roll. You want to feel like that? Go to shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back. All right. So a lot of Americans, myself included, we do not fully realize how invested China is in dividing this country and getting us to tear at each other. We just don't fully realize it. And that is exactly why we need people like my buddy Jerry Dunleavy to come on and break these stories and tell us what these dirty Chi-Coms are doing here in the United States of America. And he joins me now, chief investigative correspondent for Just the News, Jerry Dunleavy. Okay, Jerry, it is your story. What are the dirty Chi-Coms doing in my country?
So we've talked before, Jesse, about what's called the Singham Network, which is a far left, frankly, communist, Marxist, in their own admission, activist network here in the United States. They have spun up in the past to lead the protests related to opposition to ICE, opposition to Israel, kind of you name it, and whatever the issue of the day is, they will spin up and activate. And they spun up and activated right away within minutes of Trump announcing strikes against Iran over the weekend. This network was clearly waiting and ready to go, and they sort of organized a lot of the immediate protests that you saw in New York City, Washington, D.C., and around the country on Saturday, Sunday, and then into this week. That group is backed financially and linked personnel-wise to a very wealthy millionaire named Neville Roy Singham, who lives in Shanghai, is connected to the Chinese Communist Party. So these groups that are sort of financed by a openly Marxist, wealthy guy living in China, they spin up their protests against the U.S. war against Iran, which is one of China's few actual capable allies. And what the Chinese state media did was immediately, in dozens of stories, report on these protests, including quoting leaders from the Singham Network groups and showing protesters waving signs from these Singham Network groups, and these Chinese state media outlets trying to play this off like it's some sort of organic, U.S. Opposition to what's happening, when in reality it's being funded by a wealthy businessman who's living in China and is advancing the goals of the CCP. So you've got sort of this circular thing going on here with these groups and the CCP and Chinese state media, and it's all fake. It's all astroturfed and all very well organized, though. And that's kind of what China is doing. They're using these protest groups to try to make it seem like there's a big organic response in opposition to what's happening to their ally in the Middle East. But in reality, the Singham Network is behind a lot of it.
Okay. I have so much I want to ask you about this stuff, Jerry. First of all, that as much as I despise Singham and the Chi-Coms and that this kind of stuff exists, it still is impressive to be able to spin it up in multiple locations that fast. Do you have some inkling of how large people-wise this organization is? To just how many people do they have just stationed ready to go in LA and New York and wherever else?
It's clearly a lot. So there's a few different groups that kind of make up sort of the core of the Singham Network. You've got the People's Forum in New York City, which helps to organize a lot of the New York City-centric protests. And you'll see that a lot of the big protests are in New York City because of the significant organizing power that the People's Forum has. Then you've got something called the Answer Coalition, which is a national organization that has nodes all in cities all across the country. You've got Code Pink, of course, which is, I would say much of what they do is Washington, D.C., although they do have organizers nationwide. Then you have a socialist revolutionary group called the Party for Socialism and Liberation that has sort of chapters all across the country as well. And so they're able to kind of draw on that along with sort of all of the local far left socialist groups and unions and that sort of thing. They're able to kind of draw on that. So the Singham Network is very good at organizing, saying when events are going to happen, when protests are going to happen, activating their local groups, getting signage there. I'm telling you that if you look at these protests, start to look for signs from the Answer Coalition or the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And once you start to notice them, you won't be able to stop. So they're very good at organizing and activating and then drawing on sort of local far left groups, socialist groups, communist groups. And yes, they are clearly, when big events like U.S. strikes on Iran are clearly in the offing, they are waiting and ready to go, because Trump posted his video on Truth Social at like 2:30 a.m. and these groups had their day of protest ready to go, and they were firing off about it within just a few minutes. So they're very well organized, and they're good at this. Obviously, they're communists. They're pro-CCP. They're fairly nefarious, but they're very well organized. They're good. They're good at what they do.
Do you? Maybe it's a dumb question, but I am curious. These little networks they have, these little groups they have. Do you get the impression that a lot of these networks belong exclusively to Singham, or are these networks that they're always on call for whatever dirty commie cause calls? And I'm just trying to understand. I'm trying to understand all the tentacles of this network.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, those groups that I mentioned seem to form the sort of the major core. Then they have sort of media outlets, something called Breakthrough News, something called the People's Dispatch. You'll actually see like Breakthrough News in particular, much of what it does is promoting the work that the Singham Network is doing with viral videos of the protests and that sort of thing. So their media arm is fairly effective as well. When it comes to sort of the other groups that they work with, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily official members of the Singham Network, although there is much digging that remains to be done to kind of figure out whether these are informal connections or formal ones. But you will, the Democratic Socialists of America is a great example of a group that is very strong in New York City, but also has lots of chapters nationwide that is often joining in and partnering with what the Singham Network is doing. Now, whether these DSA groups are, receiving financing from Singham and from the Singham Network in the way that those other groups is, I have not made that connection yet. But they do work, closely with them on a lot of these protests and activist actions. So the Singham Network is able to tap into a lot of sort of local things, and these groups are, more than willing and happy to partner with them, whether it's DSA or a lot of these other far left groups. And then, of course, you've got, union groups and these professional protesters. And the Singham Network has just proved to be very effective at activating not just its own network, but also all of these other sort of national and local far-left socialist and communist groups.
Jerry, final one from me here. Do you get the sense that any of this is illegal? And when you're talking about this kind of money, billionaires can afford really great lawyers and really great people to work out all the paperwork and try to stay on the right side of the law. And I, of course, can take $50 and go pay the homeless guy on the corner to hold up a sign that says Jesse Kelly's awesome. Is any of this illegal?
You do, probably.
Is this illegal? Do you get the sense any of it's illegal?
So I think that there is probably, when it comes to the Foreign Agents Registration Act, what Congress has been repeatedly asking DOJ to investigate the FARA piece of this when it comes to Singham and what he's doing, just because of his close connections to the Chinese Communist Party. He's got an office in Shanghai. He's worked closely in the past with groups like Huawei. It seems he's working now, at least co-located with Chinese state media. So there's probably FARA stuff, foreign agent stuff, that should be looked into, and that I think there's probably at least a decent case on. Also, when it comes to just the tax angle and the nonprofit status of these groups, it's very likely that at least some of what they're doing is violating some of the rules related to what nonprofits are allowed to do and not allowed to do. And again, Congress has been urging for many years for the Treasury Department and the IRS to look into this. So my hope, I wouldn't necessarily say it's an expectation, but my hope is that this is all being looked at closely by the Trump DOJ, the Trump Treasury, Trump IRS. And my guess is that with gaining access to the information that they should be able to gain access to, I don't want to prejudge anything, but they there's probably at least a decent case that some foreign agent rules and tax rules are being violated here.
Jerry, keep on going, my man. I appreciate you. All right. You want to be able to grow a beard like Jerry's? Wasn't that an amazing beard? Well, you're going to need some testosterone, all right? You need testosterone. You have to have it. Your mind needs it. Your mood needs it. But where do you get it? Oh, I'm well aware that there's a new men's vitality clinic on every corner. I'm aware of that. Go down there, get a needle jammed in your arm. You think that's good for you? Or you could take natural herbal supplements from Jock. They have male vitality stacks. They have many things, but I personally take a male vitality stack. 20% increase in your testosterone in 90 days with natural herbal supplements. Nobody jamming a needle in your arm. How's that sound? How's it sound to be in a better mood all the time? Have good energy all the time? Go find out what Chalk can and will do for you. Chalk.com/JesseTV. All right? Get a subscription. Save some money. We'll be back. There have been a lot of things going on in the news, and with all this Iran stuff, it can be easy to miss some things happening domestically that matter a lot. But the Supreme Court, they have opinions. I'm sure Alex Sawyer has opinions about those opinions. Joining me now, editor-at-large, Washington Times, Alex Sawyer. Okay, Alex, first of all, California case, parental rights, what happened here?
Parental rights and religious rights, Jesse. Okay, so you had a group of parents and a group of teachers, okay, who had sued over the California school policy. I'm sure you and your listeners remember the idea of not filling parents in on when their children are choosing to identify as a different pronoun or under a different name. Basically, the schools were not letting parents know when their children were deciding to transition, okay? So teachers and parents sued and challenged that policy. The lower court granted a class action and basically kind of divided it up between parents, teachers, those with religious objections, okay? And so it basically, they said, yeah, this policy is wrong, the judge did, and granted what's called an injunction, halting that policy from going forward. The schools, the state officials basically, on behalf of the schools defending this policy, took it to the Ninth Circuit, and that injunction was lifted. So the Ninth Circuit then reversed it, allowing this type of policy to go into effect. That went to the Supreme Court, and this week the justices said, you know, hold on a second, this is, we're siding here with the parents in allowing the injunction to stay in place. The teachers were not part of the later aspect. The lower court judge kind of just honed in on the parents, especially taken into consideration their religious objection to the idea of gender transitioning and the idea of parental rights, as you mentioned, of them knowing when their child is choosing to transition at school. So this was a big win for parental rights and religious rights. It gives us a glimpse on where the justices are going in terms of these types of disputes that seem to be popping up all over the country. So it's not the end of the litigation. It goes back to lower courts. But at this time, they're saying, you know, California, this school policy, it's a no.
Okay, that sounds like a good thing. We will take it. We have to motor along because there are other things. A Second Amendment case about drug users? What?
That is right. Okay, so this is a very interesting one. You know, you can be pro-guns, but also not want someone that's using drugs to possess a gun, right? That seems common sense. However, here you have an interesting case where this guy, his home was raided by the FBI. A firearm was found, as well as cocaine and marijuana. He was not under the influence, and this is key, Jesse, he was not under the influence at the time that the gun was found and all of that, right? But he admitted that he sometimes uses marijuana. So now this case is before the court, basically on the idea of somebody who's not currently under the influence and whether or not they should face gun charges because of drug use. So one of the things the justices kind of honed in on is some of the law in relation to this, and the idea of what would be considered under the influence is looking back at the founding, okay? And so what did our founders think? Well, Justice Gorsuch pointed out that many of the founders drank alcohol either with breakfast or with dinner, and they still, you know, ratified the Second Amendment. You also had the idea of habitual drunkards were the ones that weren't being, you know, armed or weren't allowed to be armed. You don't necessarily have the idea of habitual marijuana users. There was an interesting part where Justice Barrett kind of talked about the types of drugs that are listed in the classification of this law, and even Robitussin. She mentioned, like, what if what's lawful for one person isn't lawful for another? So a husband has Ambien, uses it to go to sleep. The wife uses it one night, is having trouble sleeping. Does that make her in violation of this law? So it seems like the justices were kind of sympathetic to this man and the idea of him, you know, using marijuana infrequently, a few times, that sort of thing, and the idea of whether or not he can possess a gun. It's an interesting case just because you have states that treat marijuana very differently.
Okay, so I guess I have to play a bit of a devil's advocate here. What if they rule against this man? Like, what does this mean for states that have legalized marijuana? We don't have it here in Texas, but I know a lot of people do. I know Colorado, the whole friggin' place smells like weed. So if you have marijuana in your possession, you are a felon. If you have it with a gun, is it that widespread if they rule against it?
I think there's a couple ways that they could go. They could talk about, you know, the use. I mean, do they want to get one into the frequency of the use, or whether you are currently under the use of a drug, under, I guess, in the influence? Okay. So yeah. So if they rule against this man, I think it would be difficult. States would have to look at their laws. Right now, marijuana is just such an interesting point of discussion for reporters and even, you know, voters. Okay. Because like you said, you go to Colorado, it smells. You know, can't walk through the streets of Denver without it smelling. Some parts here in Washington, D.C., that's the case too. And even President Trump has kind of expressed that he doesn't think marijuana is as bad as other types of drugs. Well, you know, I think it's going to be hard to see where the justices would go in terms of ruling against this man. When I left the court, I think that they are going to be sympathetic to him. The question is how sympathetic. To your point, does it talk about like the amount of drug use, or are we going to draw the line about whether or not you are actually under the influence at the time? Are they going to say that this law is too broad, the idea of a habitual user, or there's an aspect that also talks about being an addict? When do you become an addict? There's a lot of questions, I think, that the justices explored about this law, and it makes me think that they're actually very hesitant to... I would not see them ruling against this man. I don't know how far they're going to go with their ruling, whether it's narrow or if it's going to be wide sweeping, but I think that they saw some issues here and what the government was trying to argue.
All right, let's move on to redistricting matters. For some reason, I feel like we keep having to talk about this. Is there one ruling coming? What is happening with New York? How often do they have to hear? What is happening?
So on the same day the justices decided to rule in favor of the parents regarding the transitioning in schools and that policy, they also issued an order in relation to New York. And New York was trying to basically gerrymander. You know, we've talked about the different states trying to, either Texas was trying to give some more Republican seats. California did so with going towards the Democrats. The Supreme Court had let those go forward, but they halted New York. And what New York was trying to do, right now they have 7 GOP seats to 19 Democrats. They were really, the contest was over one seat. It encompasses Staten Island, which is held by a Republican right now. So had it been redrawn, it would have been likely a new Democrat seat. I think it's interesting that they went ahead and blocked this. The idea of how these cases come before the judges and the justices are based on racial discrimination. The courts have really stayed away from partisan gerrymandering, but they'll get involved under the racial discrimination aspect. One of the cases that you and I have talked about in the past that we're still waiting for a ruling on this year is one out of Louisiana, and it's basically challenged an aspect of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which it talks about the idea of the racial gerrymander, racial discrimination when drawing these congressional district lines. I left those oral arguments thinking the justices are going to do something with the Section 2. I don't know if they're going to gut it entirely or limit it. But then that would mean, Jesse, that these cases that are now becoming before the court on gerrymandering, whether it's for partisan purposes or not, but they're using that racial discrimination aspect to get before the courts, would have a harder time doing so.
Alex, come back soon, as always. Appreciate you. All right. We have a wonderful light in the mood, a Medal of Honor winner, posthumously, but it is powerful when you hear how brave this man was. Hang on. All right, it's time to lighten the mood, and we love doing these Medal of Honor celebrations on this show. Maybe you remember, we played it for you, Michael Aulis, he earned a Medal of Honor in Afghanistan. Donald Trump called his parents in the kitchen, they were excited, told them, hey, he's getting the Medal of Honor. Well, now the president stood up and talked about what this warrior did.
Staff Sergeant Michael Aulis, born in 1988 on Staten Island. After 9/11, Michael enlisted in the Army, and by 24 years old, he was locked in. He loved it. He wanted it so badly. He was a squad leader serving in Afghanistan with the 2nd Battalion, 22nd Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team of the legendary 10th Mountain Division. On August 28, 2013, terrorists detonated a 400-pound car bomb on the east wall of the forward operating base, Ghazni, ripping open a 60-foot-wide breach into a compound that housed NATO coalition forces, a lot of them. 10 Taliban fighters wearing suicide vests swarmed through. From across the compound, Michael saw the pillar of white smoke rising and ran to join the fight, rushing without his gear, wearing almost no gear, no Kevlar helmet, no body armor, just one magazine in his rifle. Along the way, he encountered a Polish soldier, and together they advanced under heavy fire, very, very heavy fire. At one point, shrapnel ripped through the Polish soldier's legs, rendering him unable to walk, very, very severely hurt. In that chaos of gunfire, explosions, and charred human remains, a terrorist insurgent appeared rounding a corner with his suicide vest, fully armed, and you could see it. It was going to happen. He charged the wounded Polish soldier without hesitation. Michael raised his gun and forced himself between the insurgent and the man he just met, shielding him with his own body. And at perhaps his final heartbeat, Michael fired his weapon, and the terrorist detonated his vest simultaneously. Staff Sergeant Ullis was killed just weeks before his 25th birthday, and nobody was any more brave than that. In his final act on Earth, Michael absorbed the blast, sparing the life of that Polish warrior.
It's pretty awesome. Rest in peace, brother. I'll see you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.